This is Where We Live. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky. Starting this month, there are new rules for insurance companies. They can't deny coverage based on your medical history. They can't charge women more than men. They have to cover basic services. Also, starting this year, the federal government will subsidize private insurance for millions of people who may not otherwise be able to afford it. And for the poor in states like Connecticut, the feds have expanded their Medicaid program. This is Obamacare, a signature piece of President Obama's domestic agenda that was born in political conflict and has grown up in its fair share of troubles. The point was clear: to both lower the cost of health insurance and insure more people. Today, we'll check in 14 days after the new insurance plans first kicked in. Joining us in this segment are Kevin Counihan, CEO of Access Health CT, and Ariel Levin-Becker, health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Kevin, let's start with you. Obamacare has been a political challenge, or at least was at the outset for the president. Can you back up, give us a little bit of perspective, and assess and tell us where are we now in comparison to where we thought we would have been 4 years ago?
Well, this is the we've just thrown out the first pitch or two of a nine-inning game. We have a long way to go. We're 3 months into what is really a 3 to 4 year implementation. I think that looking at it from Connecticut perspective, which is the one that Access Health looks at, I think we're doing reasonably well. We're ahead of where we stood from a membership perspective. We have enrolled about 80,000 people now.
I should ask, enrolling 80,000 means 80,000 people, including those who have enrolled and their family members.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you. We have about 72% of enrollees have said that they were either extremely likely or very likely to recommend Access Health to a friend or a colleague. There is a 76% approval rating in our state of the ACA and of Access Health. So I think overall, I think we're doing well. Are we doing perfectly? Absolutely not. Are there things that I wish we would have done differently? You bet. But I think in the context of the time frames involved and the complexity of the challenge, I'm pleased.
So then we're now at the point where if you have signed up for health insurance, you have until tomorrow in some plans, I think still tomorrow, tell me if I'm wrong, and by the end of the month for other plans to actually have that payment processed by your insurer. Ariel Levin-Becker, you've written about this. Where are we along that process?
So for people who signed up by December 23rd, they're eligible to receive coverage by January 1st. But in order for that coverage to be activated, people have to actually make their first month's payment. The carriers all initially allowed people to pay into the month of January. So people who signed up with Connecticare have until tomorrow to make their payments. And I believe from what I've heard from them, they're getting a pretty decent rate of payment. People who signed up for Healthy CT have until the 17th to pay. And people who signed up for Anthem, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, which has gotten about two-thirds of the enrollees, they actually have until the end of the month. There have been some issues at Anthem. The company acknowledged yesterday that they have a backlog in processing people's payments. So there are a fair number of people who made their payments either by check or tried to pay electronically and haven't had them processed yet.
Now, that's not a problem that's unique to Connecticut, at least as far as WellPoint's concerned. We just heard a story on NPR from Fred Mogul out of WNYC who said that this is a nationwide problem that Anthem is seeing. Kevin, is that about right?
Well, that's what I've read. They've told us, and they've been very frank, that they have quite a backlog of work nationally to do. But again, our focus is on Connecticut. We met with them last week. They talked about some ideas they had to ameliorate the situation.
And what are they telling you? What's the nature of the problem?
Well, I think it's probably more volume of work, both phone calls, applications, than maybe they expected or planned for. My understanding, too, is that they're implementing a new administrative system concurrently with January 1st. So it seems to some extent there's this sort of perfect storm of activity. But one of the things that we've done is to volunteer ways to help. And, for example, we sent out an email blast on their behalf over the weekend with ideas for Anthem enrollees to expedite their ID card printing.
Before we follow up, Kevin, I want to remind people, this is Where We Live. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky, and we want to hear from you. Have you enrolled in Access Health CT? How satisfied are you? Give us a call, 860-275-7266. Again, that's 860-275-7266. You can email us at wherewelive@wnpr.org or join us on our website at wnpr.org. Kevin, one thing we've heard, and I know there is the – you have the nine-inning approach, which is this is a 3 to 4 year ramp up process. And implementation, though, has been a big story as we've ramped up for various reasons. Is part of the reason, though, we've had implementation challenges because the program has been a work in progress the entire time. And I don't say that in a pejorative way, but because what we're asking of people, what we're asking of insurers has changed over time, and insurers are now in this period of responding to the changes that we've asked of them.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I think that's actually well said. You know, there are complexities in many levels. There's technical complexities. For example, the integrated eligibility system is unprecedented. Number two is there's new insurance reforms with respect to no more medical underwriting, no more pre-existing condition, items that you've mentioned earlier. Those are changes. There are distribution changes. For example, we're the only state in the country to have opened up insurance stores in New Britain and New Haven. There's a lot of things here that I view as being constructively disruptive. But with those constructive disruption comes change, and change is not always easy to implement smoothly.
Ariel, you've been in touch with people seeking insurance and from insurers. What are you hearing in terms of implementation so far?
I think what you pointed to sounds about right. Early on, the deadline for people to get coverage January 1st had been December 15th, and then that was extended to December 23rd. And I think that for the insurance companies, that sort of was more of a crunch, needing to get people's information into their system, send out bills, get payments processed. I think in terms of Anthem, there are some people I've spoken to who paid far earlier, signed up well before December 15th, tried to pay then. So that doesn't explain sort of the entire issue that they're facing. But certainly there has been a crunch of applications for them to deal with later than had originally been anticipated. So that is an issue.
And that's a technical issue, right? That is if you've paid. And to be clear, if you've sent in your payment and you're with Anthem, which as I understand it is the largest of the insurers on the exchange, there should be a way, Kevin, to confirm online that your payment has been processed and then you can print out a card. Is that right?
Yeah, my best understanding of how this works is they recommend that people pay online versus over the phone. And as I understand it, if you pay online, there's about a 1 or 2 day it takes about 1 or 2 business days for that payment to go through. And then it takes about 3 business days for it to go into the eligibility system. So roughly after 5 business days or a week, an enrollee is able to print out a temporary ID card.
Ariel.
Yeah, my understanding is that for people who've paid and had their payments processed, they'll be able to, after a couple of days, print out a temporary ID card. The issue a lot of people in Connecticut and I believe some other states are having is that they sent in payments, but they haven't been processed yet. And so people in that situation have had trouble because they had no way to prove that they had paid and had coverage.
And this is all for coverage, to be clear, that would begin February 1st.
January 1st.
January 1st. So you can then pay also, in theory, by February 15th, assuming things don't change, for coverage February 1st. I mean, will this all change month by month, or am I wrong?
No, this is part of the complexity. It is different for subsequent months. So, for example, enrollment for February 1st ends on January 15th, which, of course, is just a couple of days. But payment must be in by January 31st.
I need a guidebook. This isn't the most complicated thing to implement. I mean, the easiest thing to implement, is it?
No, but it's one of the most exciting things. It's the largest expansion of health insurance access in 50 years. And when we look at things in the past, such as the rollout of Medicare, the rollout of Medicare Part D back in 2006, there were a number of complexities and bumps along the way. So this is not unprecedented.
And the important part, I guess, if you would listen to the administration on this, is that the technical glitches I guess the question is whether or not we'll remember the technical glitches, say, in 5 or 6 years once this, in theory, is implemented. Should it still be here and defeat the political challenges? And that all comes back down to the people in the end who are being insured. Ariel, you're out writing stories about the uninsured and where they're enrolling. What are you seeing, say, in Hartford where you've talked to people who are actively trying to get people enrolled?
Yeah, I think a lot of people who've been helping people sign up or trying to spread the word have gotten sort of mixed results. In some cases, they're finding people are very eager to sign up and eligible for either Medicaid or quite deeply discounted private insurance, which hadn't been available in the past. I think in some cases, though, people are finding that even those deeply discounted insurance premiums are a little too much. It might seem like a great price, but if you're someone who's uninsured and you're paying nothing for insurance now because you don't have any and you have a really tight budget, some people might have some trouble coming up with $100 or $200 a month. I've also heard from some people that there's a perception that the new coverage will be free, and of course that's not true for most people. I think there are also some worries down the road that once people who did sign up start using their coverage, in some cases people might not be aware of quite what their out-of-pocket costs are going to be. Certainly there was some effort to make sure people knew that up front, but I think it sort of remains to be seen how well people really understand the differences between deductibles and coinsurance and copays.
And Kevin, that gets down to the question of what's affordable, right? An affordable plan for someone who is uninsured, who's paying nothing now, might seem like a lot of money unless, I suppose, and tell me if I'm wrong, compare that to what is on the market now for that same person. How do we explain affordability to people in this whole context?
Well, affordability is very relative, and you're right. It is widely variable. For the example that you used, for someone that's currently uninsured and of limited means, those folks in general will probably be eligible for a Medicaid program, and Medicaid, of course, does not have the type of cost sharing arrangements that Ariella just talked about. But I think for many other folks, I think Ariel's absolutely right. If you look at data, people typically buy health insurance based on price, the provider network, and then the benefit levels. And they tend not to always know what they bought. So when a benefit statement comes in or a deductible is presented, they suddenly said, gee, what did I buy? So I think one of the elements of an Exchange 2.0 that we're certainly going to in Access Health is to focus on education. How to use a plan, how to pick a physician, how to use the emergency room. We know that 46% of ER usage in our state is non-urgent. And so there's rich opportunity for education.
Communication still seems to be – with all of this, communication still seems to be both a priority and a necessity, really. No?
It's an imperative.
Yeah. Let's go to the phones and take a call. Craig from West Hartford, you're on Where We Live. What do you say?
Hey, guys. Yeah, I just wanted to let you know I have been uninsured for the last 5 years and happily insured as of this month, I think. I went through the process and signed up for Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield, and I haven't received anything from them. And y'all have been talking about making your first payment, but my plan is 100% subsidized, so I'm curious if I've missed something, or are they just backlogged?
Ariel?
What I've heard from Anthem is that people who don't have to pay any premiums won't get any kind of billing statement in the mail. You don't have to send a check for $0, and that you should receive your card. Obviously, if you haven't received it, there might be some sort of backlog in actually getting you processed. But the first thing you should be getting through from them at some point would be your insurance card.
Now, Craig, do me a favor. Tell me what was your enrollment process like, and what are your thoughts now that you, at least in theory, are covered?
Once I was able to sit down and go through the process, it was great. Doing the research, figuring out what the best plan is for my family was the biggest challenge, and I kept going back, you know, That took weeks of establishing what would be best, and I was kind of winging it. I made some calls. The calls were answered. I spoke to people. So it was a good process.
Great, Craig. I want to let you go and thank you for your call. Kevin, you wanted to jump in before I take a break, real quick.
First, Craig, thank you for that. And I would just say that Craig's underscored something that is a national need, which is the need for better decision support tools. I'm glad to hear the enrollment process worked well for Craig, but Craig's right. Everybody needs better tools to understand what types of plans to pick for them.
Ariel?
Just a suggestion for Craig. I believe starting tomorrow and through the rest of the month, Anthem is going to be allowing people to come in and pay their bills and get temporary ID cards printed at their headquarters in Wallingford. So if you need proof that you have coverage and you can get to Wallingford, that might be an option for Craig.
Great. This is thank you, Craig, for calling in. Today on Where We Live, we're talking Obamacare. We're joined by Ariel Levin-Becker. She's the health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, and Kevin Counihan, CEO of Access Health CT. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky. When we come back from a break, we'll be joined by Sarah Varney, a reporter for Kaiser Health News and NPR based in California. And we want to hear from you. You can join the conversation. Have you enrolled in Access Health CT? Have you taken your new insurance for a spin? Give us a call, 860-275-7266. Email us at wherewelive@wnpr.org or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live.
It is a brand new day for health care for millions of Americans and for the millions of families who finally have the security and peace of mind of health coverage.
That's Kathleen Sebelius, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, in a conference call just yesterday. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. It's been more than 3 months since the health exchanges were launched. Coming up, we'll check in on California's effort to cover its roughly 7 million uninsured. But for now, we're talking about Connecticut's health exchange. And we're going to go to the phones and take Kevin from Ellington. Kevin, what's on your mind?
So I'm in a tough situation. My wife and I are both self-employed, late 50s. We make just over the maximum, so we can't get any subsidies, which in, well, I guess around the country is around $63,000, which isn't that much in the state of Connecticut. So my premium's doubled, and I now have a policy where it costs $12,000 a year for a $12,700 deductible. And because it's such a big chunk of my income, I was supposed to be eligible for catastrophic insurance. Now, the Access Health Connecticut never got that up on their website in time, so I was forced into this other plan. So my question is this. Is that ever going to be up and running, and will I be able to switch over, like, mid-year? Can I make that happen to get a premium that's a little more reasonable?
Sure. Kevin, thanks for your call. Kevin Cunahan, what's your take on that?
Yeah. Hi, Kevin. So the answer to your question is yes. When you say that Access Health didn't get this up in time, I'm not exactly sure what that means. But certainly you can give me a call, or we're happy to facilitate your gaining access to the catastrophic plan. The number is 860-757-5300, and just ask from me personally.
Kevin Cunahan is the CEO of Access Health CT. Also joining us this morning is Ariel Levin-Becker, health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Let's take one more call. Pat in Franklin. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling in regards to my brother's experience. He just informed me that he recently signed up for the Connecticut Health Exchange. First off, he did say it was a good experience. There were no glitches. And second, he said that he's now paying about a third of what he was paying for insurance when he had it a few years back. My question is, where is the other two-thirds coming in? Is that going to be subsidized by taxpayers, or is that something that the insurance companies are going to be taking less profit on, or is that something that, you know, the government, if you will, is going to be making up the difference on?
Pat, thanks for calling in. Ariel?
That's going to be paid for by the federal government, which means everybody who pays federal taxes.
Well, I would add to that
sure.
that actually the ACA, to my best understanding, is actually cost neutral in that regard. And a significant amount of it is being paid for efficiencies or reductions in existing medical programs.
Kevin, briefly, could I ask you, the phones are lighting up here, which is great, with people calling in with their own personal stories. One thing that we've been looking at, though, is who are these people? What's the breakdown of these people? One very crucial, important segment that you've cautioned us about focusing too much on too soon is our young people, because we need young people to help balance the financial stability of an insurance program. But how do you see the enrollment of young people in Connecticut so far?
Well, right now about 30% of our enrollment is under age 35, which, frankly, we're happy with. But to your point, Jeff, I think the focus on the age mix is a bit of a red herring. And the reason I say that is because the government provides very rich and significant protections to the insurance industry in the form of very rich reinsurance programs that have been made even richer. Risk adjustment programs that shares money between the plans, and also a risk corridor programs. So this focus on age, I think, makes a lot of sense, but about 3 years from now.
Those things don't necessarily make sense to someone like me who's not versed in insurance. So let me ask you, is your general proposition that even if the enrollment for young people didn't increase, that by the end of 3 years we'd still be okay because the government has accounted for that?
Right. So let me give just a quick example. Let's say that there is someone that comes in with a catastrophic claim, and let's say the claim is $200,000. The way the reinsurance program works is the respective insurance company would be on the hook for $45,000 of that, which means $155,000 gets paid for by the feds. So I understand the issue about age, and the issue about having a balanced risk pool is right, but these very rich three-year programs are done to give the program some time to stabilize. So I think it's important. We should talk about it, but it's really something we should focus in 2016.
That's Kevin Counihan. He's CEO of Access Health CT. Arielle Levin Becker is in studio. She's health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. I'm Jeff Cohen in for John Dankosky, and I want to bring in Sarah Varney. She's the senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and reports for NPR. She's out in California. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Thank you.
Do me a favor and set the stage for me in California. In Connecticut, we've got, you know, just under roughly 300,000 uninsured people before the start of Obamacare. In California, you've got 7 million uninsured people. What's it look like from out there implementation-wise?
Yeah, we are a country unto our own, basically. Well, so far, I can tell you, at least in terms of the rollout of the exchange here, which is called Covered California, there's about 500,000 people who have signed up for coverage through that website. And while California, we make up about 12% of the nation's population, our state enrollment is about 22% of the national total. And so far, there's been fairly good representation from younger folks. You guys were just talking about that. Mm. We've got about 25% of the people who've enrolled are between the ages of 18 and 34. That's below the target that the administration has set, but still, you know, generally out here, that's being seen as a positive sign. I would say where the much of the criticism has focused really on Spanish speakers and the low level of enrollment of Spanish speakers. So there's just now this new wave of ad campaigns in the Spanish media to try and really encourage Spanish speakers either to go to the website or to go to a community clinic and get help to sign up.
And now there was a website yesterday I saw where it's difficult to get all of this information translated and translated appropriately. I think the homepage for healthcare.gov, the Spanish one, is actually okay. But the deeper you dig into this complicated language, the harder it gets. Sarah, you were out interviewing people for an NPR story dealing with the homeless, and you've done stories on farm workers. You've got a different population in many respects than we do here in Connecticut. Talk to me a little bit, if you would, about the challenge of insuring farm workers.
Sure. So this is a story that I did for the New York Times, which is one of Kaiser Health News' partners. And farm workers are interesting because obviously they're not generally employed by the farm itself. They're usually brought in by a middleman, a farm labor contractor. And these farm labor contractors kind of move these armies of workers up and down the state depending on the growing season. Obviously, California has a very long growing season. Mm. We grow generally between, you know, 9 to 11 months out of the year. So this big question of who's going to pay for the who's going to pay for the farm workers' insurance? I mean, the vast majority of these folks are uninsured. Many of them are undocumented, but many of them are not. And to get a job on a farm, you technically do have to provide a valid Social Security number. So according to the farm labor contractor, these are people who are in the country legally. We know, of course, that that's not the case. But the reality is that they do actually file W-2s for most of these men and women. Mm. So that then puts them into the category of large employer. And although that employer requirement has now been delayed for a year, there's still a lot of consternation here in terms of, okay, how's the farm community going to create some type of insurance product that's going to be affordable enough for the farm labor contractors and in some instances for the farmers themselves when they do actually employ more than 50 employees?
Because you're hearing from farm workers who say, look, I have enough money now in my paycheck to pay for rent and food, and that's about it.
Yeah, these are obviously very low-paying jobs. One of the things that I think is a misnomer about the farm worker community is although the laborers themselves do tend to move up and down the state, it's not like the old days where we thought about sort of families in the back of a wagon, you know, moving up and down the state. I mean, oftentimes what happens now is either the grandparents or one of the parents will stay in a place like Fresno. Their kids are enrolled in school. And then one or both of the parents will move kind of up and down. Mm. So what's interesting is that the farm labor contractors will actually technically employ some of these people for 7, 8, 9, even 11 months out of the year. So you can't say that these are part-time workers. There was actually an exemption written into the Affordable Care Act that essentially made made allowances for farm labor, but they have to only work, I believe it's up to 3 or 4 months or something like that. Mm. So that's fine in a place like Oregon for the apple picking season or Georgia for the peach picking season. But in California, we grow strawberries almost year round.
Sarah Varney is the senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and reports for NPR. She's out in California. I'm Jeff Cohen in for John Dankosky. You can join the conversation on Obamacare today. Have you enrolled in Access Health CT? Give us a call at 860-275-7266. Right now we're going to go to Corey, who's on the phone from Hartford. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi, Corey. What do you know?
Well, I had to sign up on the exchange. I had a previous plan, but they said I had to change it, so I signed up on the exchange. And they said I had coverage that I had to pay. I paid. And then I did go to the doctor on January 6th, but I didn't have any sort of information to give them about the new plan, no insurance card or anything. And I'm just wondering what happens in this case where I have technically used the insurance, but I wasn't able to give them any information. And my insurance new plan has a copay, which I didn't pay either.
Thank you, Corey, for calling in. Yeah, Kevin, what's your response?
Well,
heard this before.
Yeah, sure. And hi, Corey. So what happens is I assume that you had to pay out of pocket or potentially paid out of pocket for your medical services. And if you did, that expense will be reimbursed by your insurance company, appropriate with the benefit plan that you selected. So you will be fully covered as of January 1st.
A bit unsettling, though, no, Kevin? I mean, you know, you've in theory paid for something. You can't prove it. Something's wrong. You want to go to the doctor. You don't feel well. It could be a nerve-wracking process, no?
It absolutely can. As a matter of fact, I assisted a woman last week who had to defer surgery because she hadn't received her ID card yet. So all those kinds of things are highly unnerving. These are the kinds of things, unfortunately, that are not unique to Connecticut. These are bumps in a brand new system. They're going to get worked through. Corey's situation is, again, very unfortunate and not unintended, but this will all get worked out.
Take another call. Claude from Salisbury. Claude, you're on Where We Live.
Yes. I live in Salisbury, which is on a border of New York and Massachusetts. And my concern, which I've seen since the very beginning, I started to enroll to see what it would be if I qualified for anything. I didn't qualify for any financial assistance. But I was very excited to get out of the pre-existing scenario because I waited for this day. I was looking forward to probably signing up with Anthem or something so I could get sort of a national PPO, only to discover there was no national PPO anymore. Secondly, I also discovered that the plans in the network and outside the network with the major carriers did not cover beyond the state lines. Connecticut does, it has, it always will, apparently, but that's already what I was in, and I have a December 1st plan, so I've got another year to go. But I was hoping to change sooner than later and get into something that would have a broader coverage, only to discover that these plans do not go beyond the state lines. And I'm wondering, you know, what can be done to correct that, because this is a real issue for, you know, Sharon Hospital, which is near us. New Yorkers can't, under their plans, come over to Sharon Hospital. They are working on it in terms of one of the plans, but the other ones may or may not come along. And it's a real issue. And you know, it doesn't just affect us here. It affects all border states around, you know, anyone who lives near a border around the country. And I don't know how nationally we could sort of fix this issue.
Claude, thanks for calling in. I appreciate it. It's a good perspective. Kevin, Connecticut's a small state bordered by other states, obviously. And people live a lot of people live along those borders. Talk to us a bit about portability. And can you, if you're insured in a Connecticut-based exchange plan, is your insurance portable, like Claude's asking?
Well, you know, I need to understand more of the details of Claude's circumstance. And Claude, I'm happy to do that, by the way, offline with you. You know, he is right that to the extent that the networks are typically constructed within the state, so the respective states, there are, as Claude also mentioned, provisions within, I thought, all the plans for people to be able to gain access to providers outside their state. If referred to by their primary care physician. I believe Connecticut's got that provision. Healthy CT does. My understanding was that Anthem did as well. But I will clearly like to investigate that and get back to Claude.
Is that a big issue, Kevin, though? How much of your time do you spend helping translate this to consumers? Is that – because – and I don't mean this with disrespect, but this is so complicated that very often even you say, I'm going to have to look into that and get back to you. I'm going to have to talk to the insurers, or, you know, we're talking about insurers and what they're recommending for payment.
Yeah.
How much of your time is self-educating and educating the rest of us?
Well, to be frank, very frank with you, I spend every day educating myself. I mean, I actually have read all 1,200 pages of the law, but I still refer to it just about on a daily basis, to your point. Do I think that, that insurance is something people understand? Absolutely not. It's confusing. It's complex. It's expensive. The concept of affordable health insurance is a bit of an oxymoron. So all these kinds of things are one of the areas I think the Affordable Care Act attempts to address. But it is a complex law. There are complex provisions, and we're all learning.
That's Kevin Counihan. He is the executive director of Access Health CT, and also joining us in studio is Arielle Levin Becker. She is health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. Joining us by phone is Sarah Varney, reporter for Kaiser Health News. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky. When we come back, we'll talk about the challenge of getting insurance to the poorest among us, and we'll also talk about the role of community health centers in the Affordable Care Act. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Email us, wherewelive@wnpr.org, or tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm Jeff Cohen, in for John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it's our weekly political news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. Colin McEnroe will lead a discussion on all of this week's news, including the announcement that a former U.S. Comptroller General is exploring a run for lieutenant governor. You can join the conversation on The Wheelhouse coming up on tomorrow's Where We Live. But today, we're talking Obamacare and its effort to get health insurance to people who haven't had it before, like people on Skid Row in Los Angeles.
What you been up to? You all right?
Yeah.
So you do come to my clinic, don't you?
No, I don't.
You haven't been there?
No,
Chris greets a woman perched on an upside-down plastic bucket with a Burberry scarf covering her head. Her eyes are clouded with drink or drugs, her cheeks smeared with ash. Her name is Martha Castro. Martha tells Chris she has slept on the streets for 4 years and has been to the doctor just once for a lung infection.
Do you realize that you can have health insurance?
No, I don't want to apply for nothing else right now.
You don't?
Yeah, I need to see my son. I need to be in touch with my son.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where's your son?
Martha is adamant that at 64 years old, she's healthy enough. And anyway, she says, she doesn't have any ID or money.
So then how are we going to have insurance for them there for that kind of clinic?
I tell her the insurance, Medicaid, is free to her, and she doesn't need ID. But that doesn't matter to Martha, who is high or drunk and perhaps touched by mental illness. That's it, she says, signaling that the conversation is over.
That's an excerpt from a story that aired on NPR and was reported by Sarah Varney. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News and NPR, and she joins us today by phone. Also joining us are Kevin Counihan, CEO of Access Health CT, Arielle Levin Becker, health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. I'd also like to welcome in Deb Poland, Director of Government Affairs and Media Relations for Community Health Center Association of Connecticut. It's a mouthful. Sorry, everybody. But Sarah, I want to go back to you and just ask, we heard that piece of tape from Skid Row. How typical was that exchange we just heard?
Oh, it was very typical. We spent a couple of days down there on Skid Row, and for anybody who's next time you're planning a trip to Los Angeles, it's actually quite a thing to see. So there's about 54,000 homeless people in Los Angeles, about 1.2 million nationwide. And in Skid Row, obviously, it's incredibly concentrated. So you have missions, you have transitional housing. A lot of folks who are getting out of prison come to Skid Row. There's a lot of hundreds and hundreds of units of transitional housing. So it's very, very concentrated there. And Martha was very typical. You know, there's, I say in the piece that when you walk into Skid Row, it's very clear that you're there. There's this very pungent smell of urine. There's burning marijuana smoke. People are playing music on the street, and it almost feels like a carnival. Mm. But there is a lot of misery concentrated in just a couple square blocks.
And what challenge to outreach workers did you face going into a community like Skid Row to translate health insurance to the average person?
The outreach worker that I went out with, Christopher Mack, was himself once homeless. That's definitely something that you see a lot in these kinds of programs. People who are, they employ formerly homeless people, A, because it gives them a job, but B, because it allows them to really understand what the folks that they're trying to talk to are going through. I mean, mean, the thing that we know about homelessness is that a vast majority of people who are homeless have mental illness. Around 80% or so have mental illness and or alcohol and drug addiction, and often both. So you're oftentimes going out during the day to try and talk to people. They're oftentimes high. They're oftentimes drunk. You know, Martha talked about how, oh, I don't have any health problems. I'm fine. If you had met her, you would clearly say that she was not fine. You know, it's possible that she had chronic asthma. She clearly could have benefited from some medical treatment. I also spent a lot of time at one of the clinics there that's right on Skid Row. And this is a place where, you know, homeless people can. And obviously one of the arguments that was made during the Affordable Care Act and that in other states where, like Texas and Florida, that are not expanding the Medicaid program, the argument that you hear often in those states are, well, these are people who have access to medical care anyway. They can always go to one of these free clinics or public clinics, or they can go to the ER if they're truly sick. And that is the case. I mean, you do have homeless people, of course, who show up in the ER. But more often what happens is they have a number of chronic diseases as well as mental illness that really tend to go untreated. So you have people who are walking around who are schizophrenic or who are bipolar. They can't get access to regular medication, or because they're homeless, they often lose their medication. So the idea here in California, obviously, which is doing the Medicaid expansion, is to say, okay, let's go out onto the street fairly aggressively, enroll people, assign them to a clinic or allow them to pick a clinic if they can make that choice for themselves, assign them a doctor, have them come in for regular checkups. And the idea is that that will be a touch point for them, not only to get their medical care back on track, but these clinics, I mean, they're very sophisticated, and they understand that obviously what you need when you're homeless is housing. So these are clinics that have counselors actually at the clinic to help people, you know, into transitional housing. So the idea is to sort of use medical care as a touch point for a larger transformation, sure, if you will, in somebody's life.
That's Sarah Varney. She's a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and reports for NPR. She's out in California. Here in Connecticut, we've got Deb Polin in studio. And Deb Polin works with the Community Health Center Association of Connecticut. Good morning, Deb.
Good morning.
So how does that same picture look from here in Connecticut? What do you see when you talk about insuring the poorest of the poor who make up a large percentage of your clients?
Yes, exactly. In Connecticut, we have 14 community health centers, or also called federally qualified health centers, and they provide comprehensive medical, behavioral health, and dental care to all people regardless of ability to pay. So people who have insurance already can access health care at a community health center, people who are on Medicaid, private insurance, Medicare, and this is what makes them really special, people who are uninsured are never turned away from a community health center. So in Connecticut, about 23% of the patients at community health centers are uninsured right now.
And the remainder, how are they covered?
They are covered, 60% of them are on Medicaid, and about 13% are on commercial insurance, and about 6% on Medicare. So I hope that adds up to about 100%.
Close enough for my numbers. So as you look at that number, I think you said 23% of your clients are uninsured. Do you anticipate that number shrinking?
Absolutely. In all of the health centers across the country, there are outreach and enrollment workers finding people who are uninsured. And there's a couple of ways to find people who are uninsured. The easiest way is they can look through their patient records and say, these people came in this week and none of them had health insurance. Let's call them and get them to come in. Another way is they're coming in every single day for health care, and outreach workers are grabbing them and saying, while you're here, let's see if we can get you signed up for either expanded Medicaid or a private plan through Access Health, and then other programs as well, like SNAP, which used to be called food stamps, and other social programs.
And are community health centers actively doing that, combing their roles, going through them, finding who's uninsured and doing outreach?
Yes, they are. And they're doing it all across the state, both in their health centers and then in community events across the state.
So when you work, as Sarah spoke about, the challenge of translating this very complicated product to all of us, obviously we're here for a whole hour trying to unpack it and understand it. What challenge? You and I spoke before about the vocabulary of healthcare and the Obamacare. How do you see that?
It's really challenging. Even if you speak English as your first language, the vocabulary of health insurance is really challenging. A monthly premium, cost sharing, deductible, all of these things can be really new terminology for people who've never had health insurance. Then you add that on top of English not being your first language, not sure how that translates, and it can be a lot of education that's required.
I want to bring in one of your outreach workers in a second. Before I do, you and I spoke, and you told me a little bit about some of the scenarios you saw of people coming in and trying to thread the needle with their insurance in terms of they were just on that Medicaid eligibility line. Tell me that story, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, ideally for the people who are coming into community health centers, most of them are really, really low income. So ideally, those who are uninsured are going to be able to get on expanded Medicaid, which will provide a really comprehensive product at no cost to the consumer. And that's best for the consumer. It's great for the providers because they know there's going to be a steady revenue stream. And it's really good for the public because we know we're trying to look at this as a public health issue. But for people who are just slightly above, that can be really challenging. And if they can't afford the premium, many of the people are deciding to remain uninsured and pay that $95 fine this year. In health centers, we're still going to be treating those people, even if they are choosing to be uninsured. That's the directive from the federal government. They'll still be able to receive services at health centers.
So that's a delicate line to work there, Kevin. You're having people who are opting to remain uninsured, and yet they'll just because of the finances of it all, it's cheaper probably for them in that scenario to stay uninsured. And then they'll still get subsidized care through their community health center. Is that how it should work?
Well, it's not how it should work, obviously. And, you know, the part of the challenges, as you know, Deb was describing, is that the folks that are uninsured miss out on many opportunities for preventive care visits, for wellness programs, nutrition programs, good dialogues with their physicians. But this is all part of the transition. And I think the fact that we're seeing that in our state right now is not surprising, that reaction by certain segments of folks. And again, I think that's why we have to have a little patience and understand that this is going to take a couple of years to fully implement.
Patience.
Jeff, I was going to say, interesting contrast. I was in Texas last year, which is a state that's not expanding, and I was at a very large community clinic in Brownsville, Texas. And of course, they're pulling their hair out because they're seeing all this money that they could be getting to help pay for the uninsured people. And what was interesting is this idea that, you know, if you just go uninsured, you can go to the community clinics. Well, the reality is the community clinics are not staffed with specialists, for example. So I was talking to a doctor down in Brownsville who said, you know, I have this patient. She was just recently diagnosed basically with breast cancer. I'm now having to call around to just people I know to see if they'll take her. So just because you go uninsured and you think you can go into a community health clinic, it's not just the preventive stuff that you're missing out on, but it's really access to specialists, which is what you get when you open up Medicaid. I mean, there are, of course, problems with access to specialists, even on Medicaid. But if you go to a place like Texas, they'd say this is better. You know, Medicaid is better than nothing.
That's Sarah Varney out in California. I want to thanks. That's a fascinating point, Sarah. I appreciate it. I want to go briefly, because we don't have a whole lot of time left, to Xenia, who's calling from Hartford. She's a certified application counselor for Access Health CT. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, Xenia. So thanks for calling in. Give me a sense of what it's like to do your job when you're out there trying to explain this very complicated product to people who need it.
Well, since the enrollment rollout, it's been very challenging. We have come a long way since October. After overcoming some system glitches, many errors, all the messages we were getting on the website, we have been able to successfully enroll many individuals into either Medicaid, the new expanded Medicaid, or a qualified health plan. So it's been very challenging, but in the very end, we have succeeded in enrolling most of our clients that walk in.
And Xenia, where do you do this work?
Well, we do this at Community Health Services in Hartford, the health center.
And how many of you are there doing the application counseling?
We have 4 certified application counselors right now doing applications.
And what's the waiting room look like? What's the line? Is there a long line of people waiting to speak with you?
Actually, yes. We've had to start giving out appointments.
Really?
Because of the length of the application process, yes.
So is it just...
By having people walk in and being referred by providers and doctors, nurses to come in and apply, but most of our patients don't have the information with them, so we have to give them an appointment to come back. And if we have someone that we're going to spend an hour and a half with or two, they'd rather just come back with appointments.
You could spend that much time, Xenia, with a single applicant?
Yes. I think the least I've personally been with one individual is about an hour and a half.
Yeah, Kevin Cunahan.
Well, that's just – it's interesting. I think what Xenia's pointing out is sort of the variability of people's experience with systems and technology and such. And the average enrollment time in our state is 45 minutes compared to about an hour and 15 minutes nationally. So it is a complex process to enroll, to the extent that you need to be well-prepared in terms of having financial information and understanding. But the process overall of enrollment, I think, as we've heard from other listeners, is really pretty intuitive and simple.
Deb Poland?
Yes. Hi, Xenia. Thank you for doing all that you're doing at CHS. And we have, just to let folks know, there's 100 federally qualified health center staff members all over the state doing the work that Xenia is doing. The difference between a health center client and other uninsured people across the state tends to be more complications in filing the application. So they may have members of their family who are undocumented and members who are documented, members who are insured and members who are uninsured. So it can be fairly complex
children,
to go through.
Children who already may be insured through the state,
correct.
But they are, but the parent may not be eligible.
Right. So it's a little bit more complicated to deal with some of the families that come into the health centers than some of the other folks who are out in the community and just uninsured.
Ariel Levenbecker?
Yeah, one thing I've heard from people who are helping people to sign up is that one thing that can be a challenge in some cases is estimating income eligibility for Medicaid or discounted insurance is based on people's 2014 income. And, for example, if you work irregular hours, I spoke to someone who is helping school bus drivers sign up, and many of them pick up an extra run during the week. They have to bid for new runs every year. So it can be very difficult to estimate what their 2014 income is going to be. So there are things like that where even if the system is sort of working as it should be, there can be things that are still challenging for people.
Sarah Varney, did I hear you out there wanting to say something?
No.
Oh, sorry. Good. So then, Kevin Cunahan, we've got just a couple minutes left. I wanted to wrap up with you. Here we are. Obviously, this is a challenging time, challenging for good reasons and bad probably. Where do you see us, though, in a year, in 2 years? Will we still be talking implementation issues, or are we going to be beyond that? And what's a year from now look like to you?
Well, I think a couple of things. One is I think we're going to have more choice. We're going to have more health plans on the exchange than we have now. I think, too, is that the consumer experience is going to be easier. We're looking, for example, at implementing an avatar right now that will walk people through the most frequently asked questions that we get prospectively.
What does that mean, an avatar?
Well, it's basically like a little sort of digital figure that is going to speak to the applicant or the CAC or broker as they enroll. They'll actually walk people through insurance terms and things to get to some of the complexities that other folks are speaking to. I think we're going to see a much smoother, even easier implementation experience. I think a lot of the issues that we've talked about today are things that people are going to be a little bit in the past. And we're going to be focusing on other things such as quality of network, quality of metrics, of education, decision support tools. A lot of things, I think, to make the purchasing of insurance simpler.
Do you think we'll still be in this? You know, it seems like every week there's a different sort of technical crisis. Do you think we'll be beyond a lot of that?
Well, we haven't really had those in our state, so I don't know, because frankly, all I care about is our state. Will there be issues in other states and in the federal government? You know, there could be, but I know in our state, I'm very confident that every month it's getting better.
That's Kevin Cunahan. He's CEO of Access Health CT. I'd like to thank him and the rest of our guests: Ariel Levenbecker, health and healthcare reporter for the Connecticut Mirror; Deb Poland, Director of Government Affairs and Media Relations for Community Health Center Association of Connecticut; and Sarah Varney, reporter for senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News and a reporter for NPR. Thank you all. You can continue this conversation on our website, WNPR.org. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Special thanks today to Heather Brandon. I'm Jeff Cohen. This is Where We Live.